You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting on KPCW, Park City, Utah.
Good morning, and welcome to the holiday week edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Allison Kulo. It is a strange holiday week here in Park City, although I did see some familiar sights as I was driving to the station. Lots of people wearing ski gear. The town lift was spinning for the first time. And, you know, while it's a different holiday week, it is still a holiday week, and we welcome everybody who's coming to visit us.
Now, something to look forward to this week. Let's give you a kind of a rundown of what we're going to be talking about this morning. So this morning, Marshall Steinbaum, he's the assistant professor of economics at the University of Utah. He's going to join us to discuss the antitrust lawsuits against Facebook. If the company is found to be engaged in anti-competitive behavior, it could change Facebook as we know it.
Next, we'll be talking to Jill Gonzalez, an analyst with Wallet Hub, who's going to join Mountain Money to discuss a recent report on 2021's cities with the least sustainable credit card debt. And yes, we made the list. Park City is ranked as the second most least sustainable, if that makes any sense, city in the country in terms of credit card debt.
And then finally, over the past few days, congressional leaders scrambled to finalize a $900 billion COVID relief deal. Tim Crist, partner with Holland & Hart, joins us at the end of the hour to help us understand what this deal means to small businesses and individuals. All this and more today on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Every day, more than half of the United States population over the age of 13 turns to a Facebook service to keep them in touch with the people, organizations, and interests that matter most to them. For them, Facebook provides an important forum for sharing personal milestones and other intimate details about their lives to friends and family. For example, announcing the birth of a child or grieving the loss of a close relative, sharing photos and videos of children and grandchildren, and debating politics and public events. So begins the lawsuit filed by the state of New York and some 47 other states against Facebook. At the same time, the Federal Trade Commission filed a similar case on behalf of the federal government.
The picture painted by the complaints of the staggering presence of Facebook in the lives of Americans and how it maintains that position is certainly not pretty. Citing numerous internal documents, the complaints allege that Facebook has achieved monopoly power over the personal social networking market in the United States, and that it maintains the power by deploying something labeled as a buy or bury strategy that thwarts competition and harms both users and advertisers.
So what do the governments hope to achieve by these lawsuits? What real harm is caused by Facebook's behavior? And how will the litigation affect the regular users of social media? How long is this going to take? And what's the likely result? And how did we get here? And what does it tell us about the state of U.S. antitrust enforcement? We're fortunate this morning to be joined by Marshall Steinbaum, an assistant professor of economics at the University of Utah and a senior fellow in higher education finance. He has written in the area of antitrust enforcement, including a recent piece in the University of Chicago Law Review, and, as I learned this week, has a most interesting Twitter feed. Good morning, Marshall. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks very much for having me.
Let's start with some background. Can you help our listeners understand a little more about the context of the lawsuits, who the plaintiffs are, and what the underlying legal structure that we're dealing with is?
Sure, yeah. There's certainly a lot going on in both of the lawsuits that you mentioned. So the basic thrust of both lawsuits is substantively the same and procedurally sort of the same. We've got both lawsuits are in federal court, so we're enforcing the federal antitrust legislation, namely the Sherman Act. You've got one lawsuit filed by the Federal Trade Commission, which is one of the two federal agencies that enforces the antitrust laws, including the Sherman Act. And the way that they do that is by filing lawsuits like this. So antitrust is one area of law, of policy, of law, which is enforced almost exclusively through the filing of lawsuits as opposed to some sort of regulatory procedure. And then we've got a separate lawsuit, for the moment at least, filed by the attorneys general of lots of different states. I think it was 47 or 48 when they were first announced. And then I think I saw last week a headline that said the few states that hadn't joined at first have now joined. I think I'm not 100% certain on that. So both the state attorneys general and the Federal Trade Commission are separately seeking to enforce the federal antitrust laws in federal court, and the claims in both lawsuits essentially stem from the harm that Facebook has done nationally through anti-competitive practices. So there's basically two types of anti-competitive practice that the lawsuits go after. One is is mergers or the purchases of rivals. So Facebook has purchased hundreds of companies, but the two that the lawsuits most target are the purchase of Instagram and WhatsApp. So these were and are social networks that kind of started not in competing directly with Facebook, but doing something that Facebook either wasn't doing on its home social network or was doing, but not nearly as well as could be done. Facebook saw these startups, viewed them as potential rivals in the social networking space. That is something, you know, so Instagram starts with photo sharing. Facebook has lots of other stuff on it. It did have photo sharing, I think, when Instagram started, but not as well. So there were a lot of users who were using Facebook for social networks and Instagram for photo sharing, and Facebook viewed that that rival, or viewed Instagram as a potential rival, that is using the attention and user base that it got through photo sharing, it could expand to include the full suite of social network, what we've come to understand as social network type services, and thus compete directly with Facebook. So instead of competing with it, Facebook bought it. Mergers can be anti-competitive. Aside from those two big mergers and then some other smaller ones that also sort of feed into the anti-competitive strategy, Facebook has also adopted certain policies that make it difficult for anybody to emerge to compete with it. So this is other functionalities that may be developed by a third-party app will seek to propagate themselves through the Facebook network by gaining access to individuals who use Facebook and then their friends via Facebook. Basically, Facebook conditioned access to its social network on not competing with Facebook. So you had to say, to be a third-party app using the Facebook interface, you had to commit to Facebook that you would not offer any of the services that Facebook offers, as well as not interface with other social networks that compete with Facebook. So that is in the sort of antitrust lingo that's called exclusion, where it's saying if you want to deal with us, you can't deal with anybody else who we view as our competitor. And Facebook adopted those policies and then enforced their own policies by disconnecting third-party apps that it viewed as violating those policies or doing things that would be potentially anti-competitive. So those two basic elements, mergers and anti-competitive conduct, are the basis of both the FTC's case as well as the state attorney's general case.
The concept of buying up competitors as they begin to grow, that's not new in terms of antitrust enforcement. How does that fit in the historical context of where we have seen prior enforcement efforts?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when the antitrust began, the dawn of antitrust, at least at the federal level in the U.S., with the Sherman Act of 1890, it basically makes monopolies and what's called monopolization illegal. But the way that the law was first enforced essentially invited companies to merge, that is to say, create a monopoly, exactly to escape liability under the law. So the early cases under the Sherman Act penalized companies that were working together to create a monopoly, but not that were the same company. And so it became advantageous to lots of companies in all sorts of different industries to merge with each other exactly so that they could execute a monopolization strategy, even though that would seem to be, facially inconsistent with the act. So that we had something in the United States called the Great Merger Wave that started in 1895 because there was a Supreme Court case basically that said that if you merge with your competitors, then you can't be liable under the Sherman Act. Starting in 1895 until 1903, when there was another Supreme Court case that penalized a company for, in effect, merging. We had this great merger wave where pretty much every industry became monopolized. And as a result of that, the Clayton Act of 1914 penalizes mergers as well as anti-competitive conduct. So the idea was the Sherman Act just makes monopolies and monopolization illegal. That is to be enforced through the courts. The courts ended up permitting a lot of the behavior that has the effect of creating monopolies, sort of the constituent paths along which you can go to create a monopoly. The Clayton Act came in 1914 and made each of those constituent behaviors illegal in itself, including mergers. Now, as it happened, it's been hard for the federal laws to really police mergers, even despite the Clayton Act. In effect, it didn't really work until antitrust amendments in 1950. And then since 1950, and especially a law that was passed in 1974, in effect, mergers have become the main locus of antitrust enforcement, or I would say in terms of the time spent by the enforcement agencies. Certainly, that's the effect of what's happened. So the enforcement regime has shifted such that if a company wants to merge, they sort of bring their merger to the federal agencies and get the approval of the federal agencies. That approval is granted in the overwhelming majority of cases, and then the companies proceed to merge. So that is what happened in Facebook's case with Instagram and WhatsApp, as well as its hundreds of other mergers. Some of those mergers are so small that they actually don't necessarily mean they don't necessarily fall under that regulatory apparatus, but the Instagram and WhatsApp mergers did. The FTC, now the agency that's filing this case, approved those mergers. So Facebook brought those mergers to the FTC. The FTC considered them, approved them, and now, in effect, by filing this case saying this series of mergers led to an illegal monopoly, the FTC is in effect saying we made a mistake in approving those mergers one by one.
So knowing that that mistake was made and that they couldn't necessarily foresee the buy and bury strategy that took place afterwards, knowing how that's going to need to change in the future. The complaints discuss network and tipping phenomena. What are these and how are they relevant to the litigation?
Yeah, they're super relevant in short. So in antitrust, it's legally mandatory to show that whoever is being sued, in this case Facebook, has market power because the idea is certain behavior can be benign if it is undertaken by firms that don't have market power, but that same behavior can have harmful effects if it's undertaken by a firm that does have market power. So, for example, Facebook denying access to third-party apps to the social network, in general, businesses are allowed to decide for themselves whom they do business with. So it's not illegal to cease to do business with someone, for the most part. It can be illegal to cease to do business with someone if you're doing it for an anti-competitive effect that has the effect of prolonging your illegal monopoly power. And that is basically what is being alleged in this case vis-a-vis conduct. So the legal significance of the social network and network effects is to establish that Facebook has market power. The specific idea of the network effect is that for any one user, you have to be on Facebook, or I should say, yeah, you have to be on Facebook to connect with your friends. Another way of putting that is that were you to be considering, do I want to use Facebook as my social network versus something else? The fact that everyone already uses Facebook, and specifically all your friends, the people that you want to connect to on the social network already use Facebook, means that you have to use Facebook too. So it's not like a canonical competitive market where a consumer is choosing for themselves in the absence of any of these constraints. You know, do I prefer, you know, if I want to go out for dinner and it's like, okay, well, if there's just a few, 10 different restaurants and you decide, you know, I want to go to one of those 10 restaurants, you know, that's generally normal. But, you know, if the restaurants have kind of a monopoly on all your friends, and like if you go out to any one of the 9 where your friends aren't, then you can't have dinner with your friends versus the one that where all your friends are, then you're going to choose that one. And, you know, for example, that would mean that restaurant can charge you a higher price because it knows that you don't want to go anywhere else. In the case of Facebook, it's a little bit more subtle than that because Facebook in general doesn't charge its users, at least not its customer users, individuals. It doesn't charge them for access to the network, but nonetheless, it can claim their attention by virtue of these network effects and then use the fact that it has this market power, that is, consumers don't want to go elsewhere, in order to engage in all sorts of anti-competitive conduct, including extracting user information that users either don't know that they're giving up or would prefer that it not be taken from them, but they don't really have a choice.
You know, Marshall, I'm old enough to remember the breakup of AT&T and how the government achieved something by creating a number of different so-called baby bells. What are they trying to do here? In other words, what's the remedy and how can you visualize something? If these litigations were successful, what would happen to Facebook?
Yeah, that's a great question to compare it to the breakup of AT&T, because I think that does offer somewhat of a cautionary tale, at least now with the hindsight of almost 40 years. You know, that was a national telephone monopoly that essentially, it controlled the entire long distance network. And then in local areas, either it had its own local telephone affiliate, or if it was an independent, the independent, agreed to operate under AT&T's directions, according to its policies in exchange for being able to interconnect with AT&T's long distance network. The company was eventually broken up after a long and complicated antitrust case, and it created these baby bells that were supposed to be fully independent of the parent AT&T, the former AT&T. And what ended up happening is the, in my view, like re-monopolization of the telecom sector, because eventually those baby bells were permitted to merge with one another, pretty much starting in the 1990s, to the point that we now have kind of the renewed AT&T. I mean, that is one of the baby bells. Southwest Bell grew to the point that it purchased the former parent and kind of reestablished the entire national monopoly. Now, telecoms is way different than it was in 1984. It's not just about telephone. Part of the justification for that permission to kind of re-erect the national telephone monopoly is just the idea that telephone network is less important now than it used to be because we have all these other ways of interconnecting. In terms of, keeping that history in mind, what is the government and the state's attorneys general trying to achieve with this, and what will, should it be successful, sort of what does an effective remedy look like? It seems certainly that they're looking to break up, to retroactively revoke the mergers of Instagram and WhatsApp with Facebook. I would say if that's the remedy, then they will also need to impose what amounts to a regulatory restriction on those broken up entities that essentially forbid them from operating anti-competitive business models vis-a-vis third-party apps again. So, the concern would be that even if there's three social networks instead of one, the network effects will still predominate, so you can get sort of a segmentation of the market. But suppose that it breaks up such that there's a third, all the market share that Facebook currently has is broken up equally between those three social networks. In social networking, due to network effects, there could still arise a situation in which there's basically no chance for any user of any one of those three to switch to one of the other ones. So they'll still have as much market power vis-a-vis their own customers, despite having fewer customers. So that would be an unfortunate outcome. I mean, I guess you could say that if you have three companies operating exactly the same business model that Facebook is currently operating as one company, that would still be somewhat better, if not, a fully effective remedy like the one I would hope eventually gets used in this case. But I still think that, this case is legally ambitious. So we'll see. We don't know exactly whether this breakup will happen. And I think even if it does happen, we need to make sure that it doesn't have that kind of self-defeating aftermath.
So how long is this likely to take for this to all go through? And do you feel like just even filing of the complaints will have any would that cause Facebook to kind of modify their behavior just by the filing of these complaints?
I would have thought it would cause them to stop merging with companies and buying out startups, but apparently not. I think I saw another headline that they just did another merger last week or something like that, even after these complaints were filed. In expectation of a lawsuit like this, Facebook took technical steps to more completely integrate Instagram and WhatsApp in Facebook last year, I think. And now, one thing that, so the AT&T case you referred to previously, that took 10 years to adjudicate, and ultimately the remedy seemed to be, you know, pretty much the nuclear option at the time. In my view, did not bear fruit in the way that it should have due to sort of subsequent poor policy decisions. Other than AT&T, the most recent major antitrust monopolization case like this was against Microsoft in the late 1990s and early 2000s, and that also was not a success in terms of remedy. This is a very time-consuming litigation, and it's not entirely so. You know, it's not certain by any stretch of the imagination that Facebook will lose. And then I think the dynamic that occurred in the Microsoft case is unfortunately quite likely to recur here, where, you know, even in the good outcome where the suits are successful at the district court level and you get a robust remedy, the federal appellate courts feel empowered to second guess the evidence presented at the district court on the basis of what, in my view, are flawed economic theories, and kind of say, you know, take the prerogative into their own hands to dial back the findings in favor of the government at the district court level, such that, you know, essentially the remedy becomes entirely toothless after the facts. And, you know, in that case, the federal legislation against Microsoft, as well as the state legislation. So actually, one of the reasons why this case is probably filed separately, even though it more or less alleges the same facts and the same violations of the law, is that in the Microsoft case, the federal agency's antitrust case and the state attorneys general were grouped together. And ultimately, there was this pretty negative decision at the appellate court level that dialed back a lot of what had been determined at the district court level. And then in the aftermath of that, the federal agencies basically kind of pretty much agreed to settle the case for this settlement that, as I previously characterized, did not have any great impact on Microsoft and its business model. Some of the states after that did not want to agree to the appellate court decision. They thought basically that we should keep fighting, and ultimately the federal agencies were able to buffalo the states into agreeing to what some of the states considered to be a weak settlement. So I suspect the reason the states have gone their own route on this is because they foresee at least one possible outcome being a settlement agreed to with the feds that the states don't think is adequate. But anyway, so this Microsoft case, depending on where exactly you started, lasted from like 1996 until 2002 when this settlement was ratified. That's actually, by the standards of a complicated antitrust case, you know, pretty brisk the way the federal judiciary works. And again, you know, you could date the Microsoft case a good deal earlier than that, to the early 1990s, given some of the proceedings that happened. So for this, and I think AT&T took 10 years, so, you know, we're looking at years and years of litigation here. You know, what the complaints allege essentially is something that Facebook can't just agree to stop doing because it's constitutive in the nature of the company. So they sort of have to fight it, and, you know, they can't just say, well, yes, we'll do what you say, you know, please get off our back. And so, you know, this is going to be a lengthy proceeding.
So, Marshall, thanks for spending the time with us. I would really, probably if we had more time, I'd like to talk about the larger issues with the antitrust enforcement system generally, and maybe we'll get you back to do that sometime next year. We've been talking to Marshall Steinbaum from the University of Utah Department of Economics. Mountain Money will be right back after this. Thanks for spending time with us.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. This interview was previously recorded. With the economy still on shaky ground as COVID-19 cases rise and the holiday shopping season kicks into gear, the personal finance website WalletHub released its report on 2021's cities with the least sustainable credit card debt, in addition to its latest credit card debt study. I opened this email from WalletHub on December 8th, and when reviewing this report, I saw that Park City, Utah, was listed as the community with the second highest, least sustainable credit card debt. Joining us this morning is WalletHub analyst Jill Gonzalez. She's going to take us through the report and discuss what this means for our community. Jill, thank you for joining Mountain Money.
Thanks for having me.
This study is one that no one wants to rank high on, and yet Park City, Utah was listed as the number two city in the nation with the least sustainable credit card debt. Can you explain how this list was calculated?
Absolutely. So this is something that we've been looking into for a number of years. The cities with the most and the least sustainable credit card debt, and that term sustainable really comes from the last recession. So how much, you know, debt did people rack up before we started seeing delinquencies and charge-offs, things like that? So we looked at a number of different things. First of all, we looked at the median credit card balances of more than 2,500 cities. And we look at TransUnion credit data to also calculate the cost and the time required to pay off those balances.
And so you've then produced a list, and it had the top 10 least sustainable credit card debt and the top 10, most sustainable. But I know that many people transfer credit card balances to cards with low or no interest to save money. Are these transactions counted as paying off credit card debt?
As far as the actual balance payoffs, we're really looking for that pay down. So when you have, you know, a balance that you transfer, you're still transferring that debt. You still have that credit card debt. So that's not essentially what we're looking for. We actually are seeing the payoffs and how that is translated on your credit reports. And that's where that TransUnion data comes from.
So knowing that our community was put on this list, how should we look at this new information about our community? And does the growth of credit card debt affect local economies?
Absolutely. So the way that this ranking works, I mean, we looked at over 2,500 US cities. So most cities are ranked here. It's where they fall in the ranking that should be concerning or not. So the 99th percentile here is actually not a good thing. That means that your city has one of the least sustainable credit card debts. Park City, Utah is in that 99th percentile. Right now, the median credit card debt per person is just over $5,395. But because of the unemployment numbers there and because of how much the average person makes there, that payoff time adjusted for income is going to take 155 months for the average person in Park City to pay off years. And of course, we're only probably adding to that debt right now. So that's a huge problem for the individual. And for local economies, that's also very affected as well, because these people are not essentially able to participate fully in the economy because they have so much debt withstanding.
I did notice on the list that Park City, Utah is the most northern city in the nation as far as least credible or least sustainable credit card debt, with other locations listed in Georgia, Texas, and Florida. And the areas with the most sustainable debt were mostly in California. Are there different economic conditions in the nation that account for this?
Absolutely. So a lot of this has to do with debt to income ratios. So more affluent communities are going to be better off here, you know, which does tend to make sense. But when the incomes are higher, they can sustain higher debts. They also take less time to pay off. So where we're seeing incomes that are stagnant, where we're seeing lower incomes, we're also seeing that higher debt to income ratio. And that makes sense too. You know, people are sometimes dipping into credit cards and using money that they don't necessarily have to pay for necessities in those cases. So they're using credit cards to pay for rent. They're using credit cards to pay for health insurance premiums, using credit cards to pay for food and utilities. And, you know, those are needs that they then can't necessarily pay off at the end of the billing cycle that keep adding up.
So one of the items that came, or one of the facts that came out of this report was that consumers repaid more than $119 billion in credit card debt through the first three quarters of 2020, which is an all-time record. And it's the first time in 35 years consumer paid down credit card debt during the third quarter of the year. What factors contributed to this trend?
Yeah, so really the first three quarters of 2020 saw some of the highest credit card debt pay down that we've seen in decades. That's in large part due to the stimulus in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll probably end the year with a small overall reduction in credit card debt, but there will still be, you know, a mountain of debt left in 2021 with an overall economy that isn't going to be looking that much better. So there's going to be, you know, some type of breaking point here. And that's kind of the same thing that we saw back in 2008 and back with the last recession. You know, we were building until, you know, something broke. And that's where, again, the debt became just unsustainable.
So what you had said is that some of this payback was a result of the funds that people received from the federal government stimulus check. So what does this report tell us about the health of consumers? Is there still, I guess, good practices being made and good strides towards reducing debt? Or was it purely just based on that stimulus?
I would say it was probably based on that stimulus just because we hadn't seen payoff like that in decades, you know, in 35 years. So I would say, you know, that's really the outlier here. In terms of, you know, learning from our lessons, I think that after the last recession, there was more sense of saving and not spending frivolously. But I would say, you know, those lessons have been kind of unlearned in recent years. So I would say those are still habits that we need to build back that we might be learning again now.
And what are those habits? What type of advice could you give consumers about those types of healthy habits they should have with regards to credit card debt?
Well, again, you know, credit cards are using money that we don't necessarily have unless you have set up, you know, auto pay, unless you're paying your bill at the end of every month, which would be great habits to get into, but maybe not necessarily habits that you can get into right now. But other than that, I would say, you know, making sure that you are budgeting for your needs. So for rent, for your utilities, for more than ever, healthcare insurance premiums, and then making sure that you are able to pay them hopefully in full by the end of each month. As this also really affects your credit score. And that's one thing that I think we've definitely seen take a tumble during the past 9 months or so. And that also has lasting effects on what kinds of APR and interest rates you get on credit cards moving forward, loans moving forward. So one thing I've been saying to people is that I think we've seen a lot of people say, you know what, this is a bad time for me financially. That's that. There's nothing I can do about it. But it is really important to stop the bleeding now and to make sure that you are kind of taking back control of your finances, that you are preventing any more credit score damage. And one way to do that is to look at your credit card ratio, your utilization ratio, should be around 30 to 40% of your overall credit limit. I think that would help things here as well.
And is there the ability for consumers to be able to contact their credit card companies? Are there options for, you know, payment plans? Can they get their percentage decreased? Or is everyone kind of stuck with what they've got?
No, I mean, now more than ever, if you haven't already called your credit card issuers, you absolutely should. So the banks, unlike the last recession, were really proactive here. They kind of got ahead of this situation back in March and said, listen, we are offering help to people who are affected by the pandemic financially, who have proof of being financially impacted. And we're willing to work with them. And that looks like a variety of different things depending on your account. It could look like a decrease in your APR indefinitely, or at least a decrease in your interest rate for as long as the pandemic lasts. It could look like a payment plan. If you're not able to pay the minimum on your credit card bills, they could come up with a lower minimum for you. So some type of payment plan to work with you here. It could look like forgiving a late payment or two, if that's something that had happened. Late payments hugely affect your credit score. So if you're able to get them forgiven or proactively forgiven, that would be a huge help as well. But you have to call them yourself. You know, they are offering help. It's up to you to ask for it and to take them up on it. So I wholly advise, you know, as soon as you hear this, to really get on the phone with them. The wait time might be longer than usual, but it's absolutely worth it.
Great advice, and I appreciate that. I want to take, you know, just a step back again and look at kind of the nation as a whole. How will credit card debt levels look like, or what will they look like after Q4 data comes in?
Well, that's what we're wondering as well. As I said, I think that we will end the year with a small reduction in overall credit card debt, but that reduction comes from a huge number. I mean, Americans started 2020 with more than $1 trillion in outstanding credit card balances. That was the third year in a row that that happened, after 2018, 2019, and now 2020. So we're on pace to begin 2021 in slightly better shape, but that's really not saying much.
Understood. Knowing that we're having a transition in the federal government, what is the outlook, or what actions are foreseen that could be taken by the Federal Reserve to affect credit card debt in 2021?
Well, I don't think the transition is really going to affect what the Federal Reserve does for a while, and that's because of the pandemic. I think that they're going to keep rates extremely low for years to come, because it's going to take years to recover from this. So the same things that happened after 2008, you know, essentially record low interest rates, I think we're going to see for a few years now, too.
Well, we've been speaking with Wallet Hub analyst Jill Gonzalez. Jill, I appreciate your time today. Thank you for joining Mountain Money.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Mountain Money will be right back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. Congress had said that they wouldn't leave D.C. until a new relief funding deal was reached. Just last night, congressional leaders announced that they have secured a deal for a $900 billion rescue package. From individuals to businesses, all of us have been watching and waiting for additional relief from the federal government. Joining us this morning is Tim Crisp, partner at Holland & Hart, to take us through what the new relief package looked like. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. So can you take us through perhaps the major points of the bill that Congress is looking at, and what types of compromises were made in order to get to reach to this agreement?
Well, that's a great question. We have the outlines of the bill that have been announced. The actual bill has not been released or submitted to either house in Congress yet. But what we do know is there was a huge compromise between what the Democratic Party was seeking, which was over $2 trillion in aid, compared with a much smaller amount that the Republicans were willing to do. So they struck a compromise at roughly $900 billion is what we know about. It has relief to small businesses, certain other businesses. It has direct stimulus payments to individuals, and it also has some federal supplemental unemployment benefits to unemployed individuals.
So let's break that down a little bit. First of all, where does the $900 billion number fit in terms of the back and forth we've seen over the last 6 months of what people were willing to do prior? It seems to me that at one point there was probably a higher number that could have been reached. Is that right?
Well, we don't know. What we do know is the last time that Congress was able to reach agreement on a number and on a bill was at the end of March with what they call the CARES Act. And that was a huge, huge amount of federal spending. There were many Republicans in Congress who were not at all happy with that amount of federal spending and weren't eager to ante up again. It did provide some much-needed relief to individuals as well as businesses. Clearly, a lot of that money ran out, and with businesses having to shut down in many parts of the country, there was an ever-increasing need and more Americans becoming unemployed. So I think there came a consensus from Congress and the White House that we needed to provide some relief, but what conservative, fiscally conservative Republicans in Congress were willing to do versus what the Democrats were holding out for, they just weren't able to reach a deal until this point.
Now, while we don't have legislative language, and it's interesting to me that we don't, let's talk a little bit about what we do know about the specific categories of aid and what the kind of amounts are. What do we know specifically, for example, about aid to small business?
Sure. So the aid to small business is by and large going to be coming through reopening the Small Business Administration's Paycheck Protection Program loans. This was something that was opened under the CARES Act in early April, and it's a forgivable loan program so that for qualifying small businesses and nonprofits, they could get up to $10 million in lending based on their revenues from 2019. If they spend it in the right ways and keep folks on the payroll, they can get all or a portion of that money forgiven over time. Now, that program ran out it expired earlier this year. And so while there are companies that still have PPP loans outstanding, the window has closed and you aren't able to get a new one. Also, under the old program, there was a stipulation that you could only take one PPP loan and you could never take another one. Congress has apparently changed that. So now businesses that have previously taken a PPP loan can now get a second forgivable PPP loan. And Congress is apparently appropriating $284 billion in this tranche for the PPP program.
I was on some bank websites last week, and one of them was kind of hinting at this bill coming through and to, you know, come back and start applying for the funding through them. And so my question is, you know, is there any information or prediction on how fast businesses can apply and receive funding through this tranche?
Yeah, that's a great question. What we are hearing is that the bill is likely to be introduced first in the House today and passed within hours after introduction. Same thing with the Senate, and the president has promised to sign that, and it becomes law. It will take a while, even though this PPP program has been up and running. It's been shut down for a little while, but at least the SBA has a portal and they have a mechanism and they have rules in place from the first go-around, which they didn't, and it took them a while to get up and running. And they also have these arrangements with lenders. And so banks and credit unions who lend to small businesses are going to be much, much better set up. They're going to know the rules of the game, and hopefully it will be a program that will be open that businesses can apply for, if not this week, then early next week.
So let's turn to a second category, which would be the unemployment benefits. Tell us a little bit about where we ended up on, or where it appears they're going to end up on that.
Sure. So, of course, unemployment benefits are primarily a state creation, and the state pays those out. And those vary tremendously in terms of duration and the amount of payment from state to state. And so what Utah's unemployment program varies from what Nevada's or Colorado's is. What the CARES Act did was it created a federal supplemental unemployment benefit so that unemployed persons were getting an additional amount on top of what the state was paying out. That program expired last July. And up until this point, Congress hasn't been able to reach a deal on resuming that program. Under this new legislation, what we understand is that there will be an additional $300 per week for all workers who are receiving state unemployment benefits, and that this is being carried forward through the middle of March in 2021.
I know that there was regulations or pieces, policies put in place to stop evictions, and that those were going to be ending at the end of the year. Do you have any sense if those are extended through this new bill?
Yeah, great question. There's been a federal moratorium on eviction proceedings for renters who get behind on their rent, and that was to expire at the end of the year. That's now being carried forward at least through the end of January, we understand. So at least, you know, families who are in danger of being evicted can now know that they are going to get through this holiday season and at least through perhaps some of the coldest months of the winter before they potentially are facing that again. This potentially could be extended down the road. We just don't know.
And is there a cash payment component as well in this bill, analogous to the $1,200 payment from the CARES Act?
Yeah, there is. It's less. So it's basically about half the benefit. There are direct payments that will be made of $600 per person for individuals who make up to $75,000 in earnings per year. and $1,200 for couples who make up to $150,000 per year. So it's roughly half, I think it's exactly half of what the CARES Act did, but it's at least something that puts money back in the hands of families who desperately need it. In addition, families with dependent children can receive a payment of up to $600 per child. So for a Utah family of four who makes less than $150,000 a year, they're going to be receiving a stimulus payment direct from the federal government of $2,400.
As these negotiations were coming to a close, there was some reported controversy regarding an instinct by Senator Toomey of Pennsylvania with respect to limiting the power of the Fed in a post-Trump Trump administration era. Can you explain what that was about?
Sure. It was basically an ideological difference, and Senator Toomey was not happy about the Fed taking on this direct lending or indirect lending role that it had under the CARES Act and doing this emergency lending. Senator Toomey and, frankly, many other Republicans in Congress felt that this was putting the Fed in an area where central banks like the Fed really should not be handling. So the CARES Act established some programs, the main one being what was called the Main Street Lending Program for small and medium-sized businesses, so that if you were a small business, you could get one of these non-forgivable Main Street Lending Program loans in addition to a PPP loan. If you were a larger one and you weren't too large over the size threshold, which was much, much larger than a PPP loan, you could medium-sized businesses could still take advantage of that program. Basically, that program is shutting down at the end of the year. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin announced that the unused funds were being returned to congressional coffers. And despite protest from Fed Chairman Jerome Powell, that program is winding up. And basically, Senator Toomey's insisted language that he got a compromise on means that the incoming administration won't be able to revive that program without further congressional action.
I know that many business owners that are listening to this show are wondering if the stimulus money that is given to businesses is only available under the PPP, or are there other ways businesses can receive support underneath this new bill?
Yeah, there are a few other categories, but they're much, much more narrow. So, for example, $20 billion is being earmarked for what they call EIDL grants. These are grants, not loans, but they're basically set aside for very, very small businesses and minority institutions. That's one avenue. There's also a $15 billion appropriation for aid to live entertainment venues, independent movie theaters, and cultural institutions. We don't know what that's going to look like exactly. $45 billion is set aside for relief for certain transportation businesses, such as airlines, airports, concessionaires at airports, certain other transportation types of businesses. There's also aid to municipalities and states for vaccine distribution and covering some of the costs that they've incurred for COVID testing and things like that. But there's not other the primary avenue for most businesses is really going to be limited to small businesses, and it's really just through the reopening of the PPP program.
One of the wonderful things about any large piece of legislation is that there are inevitably these smaller provisions that you may wonder about from a third-party perspective. Why is that there? And one of the ones I wanted to ask you about was this apparent inclusion of a full deductibility of business entertainment meals. What's the story on that one?
That's a great question, and I don't know the backstory on that one, but like with the CARES Act, one of the heavily employed industries with great job security is apparently the lobbying industry in Washington, and I suspect that this was something where some lobbyists were able to get this provision inserted. Looking at it from a glass half full perspective, this is going to benefit a lot of restaurants and other businesses that have suffered greatly during this pandemic, with prolonged shutdowns, capacity limitations and folks just not going out. And so to the extent that this encourages spending at those kinds of businesses and through that tax deductibility, that's potentially an upside that can help to keep them afloat.
It does seem like a pretty indirect way to help restaurants, particularly because it's probably going to have the vastly disproportionate impact on large, urban, very high-end, very expensive restaurants. But again, it is, as you say, an industry that's been hit pretty hard.
Definitely. I mean, there's no question in my mind that New York restaurants are going to benefit more than, say, those in Heber City. But long story short, it's if you're a restaurant owner, these have been a very, very tough 10-month period. And this any kind of glimmer of light, anything that encourages spending at their establishments, I'm sure is welcome relief to them.
Let's talk about what's not in there. In other words, there was a lot of push from various constituencies about things that were desirable in a federal package like this. What's missing in terms of big goals for either the Republicans or the Democrats?
Sure. Well, the Democrats wanted much bigger package and more relief, and they didn't want the Fed's Main Street lending program shut down. So they had to make some compromises. The Republicans held out for a very, very long time. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, in particular, was holding out on any kind of deal, looking for broad immunity to businesses for lawsuits and claims related to COVID exposure. So he was looking to get liability protection for businesses. At the end, Speaker Pelosi held out. There was a stalemate for a long period of time, and Senator McConnell did not get his way on that one.
So knowing that we're running out of time, wanted to just have you perhaps summarize what advice you would give to businesses as they determine whether funding within this package is right for them.
Sure. I'm going to focus here just on the PPP program because I think that's really the vast majority of small businesses and nonprofits who will benefit from this. So if you are a small business or a nonprofit, the great news is you can take out a PPP loan if you didn't take one out before, or even if you did. There are some eligibility criteria, some relating to size, some relating to the type of business. I would encourage you to pick up the phone today and talk with your banker even before the bill is signed into law and kind of get in queue so that you can get your application in as quickly as possible and hopefully get approved for this loan. It's a limited amount that's appropriated. Once it's gone, there's no guarantee that Congress is going to reappropriate and replenish those funds.
Tim, we appreciate your time. We've been speaking with Tim Crist of Holland & Hart. You've been listening to Mountain Money. We'll be back right after this.
You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.